Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, April 18th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here located near the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We here at Mind Shifters Radio hope everybody does that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll see it. I'll be able to turn on the microphone and announce it by your area code, and we can have a conversation. If you'd like to submit a comment or a question or feedback and you do not wish to call or don't have access to call in live directly, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org and or you can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And once we get that from you, we will address the comment or question or feedback on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. We are appreciative anytime anybody chooses to do that, either live through the phone or on email, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service, and that's just a whole heck of a lot easier to do when we know how these things are landing for you. So let us know, if you will, what we can do to be of service. Area code 610, you're in the air.
Howdy, Dr. Tim. Susan here.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. I have a question about this, the Laughing Jesus book. Those guys, and I'm only about two-thirds through, but they just are having a heyday, ripping down every possible belief we might want to have about the validity of this, that, and the other. Old Testament, New Testament, they're all derived from something else and written by somebody else. And it's brutal. But on the other hand, here we have not only Christianity, but we have other world religions which the essence of them, the best of them, is the best. And how did that all happen? There's something wonderful about Christianity, Christ-like, Jesus-like, about the people who carried whatever it is that's good, and I know there's a lot bad, whatever is good, all the way into the presence, so that we can find our way to doing this work and kind of freeing ourselves from bonds of various kinds, darkness, evil, whatever it is. I don't even know how to form. It's just blowing my mind that somehow we got hold of something through the mists, probably. And St. Paul is painted in a rather unfriendly way, but some of what he wrote is totally gorgeous and inspired. Some of it isn't. It's as if it almost doesn't matter what is, quote, real, unquote, because something even more real was born from all that mess and all those efforts. Oh, and that's a cat who's visiting. Okay. Come on, Hattie. Am I making any sense so far?
Let's see. Yes, absolutely. I'm chuckling that you would even question that, but yes, you're making sense. And is there a question you have for me from that, or you just want to?
Or just I don't think I do, actually, and I have a whole other something that I want to talk about. But this book is kind of running parallel to my business of going to church and saying prayers and following the liturgy and singing in the choir. And I'm thinking, this is not all bullshit. Something good came out of this. And particularly, I feel as if my parish has really got a handle on whatever was good about Christianity, whatever Christianity's origins were, and however many fake prophets and seers and messiahs were wandering around in Jerusalem at the time. And man, Timothy Fry and Peter Gandy sure go to town on that one. I don't know what they're getting out of doing this, and I couldn't verify all that they're saying. I don't even want to bother. But I figure something is true about what they're saying. We're told to go below where we were to a better place, a truer place that has nothing to do with a lot of what we've been thinking is essential. You seem to mind a lot less. You got rid of your Christianity quite a while back, and the essence of it you still retain. and Michael Rice does too, in the work you're doing. This book, if it were read by somebody new to the faith, would just run screaming and say, oh my God, I've been so misled, I've been scammed, this is terrible, I'm never going to set foot in a church again. Somehow this book is just a puzzle to
well,
me, but it isn't.
Let's just talk about one thing you could use that book for. You could use that book as a launching pad or a launching point for choosing to live in the moment with direct observation rather than from belief.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's good.
And so, you know, the direct observation of how I prefer my life and I prefer my relationships when I'm coming at life from this, you know, whatever you want to call it, the true love perspective, the Rachma perspective, the eight C's from Dick Schwartz's perspective, these loving, calm, centered, creative, connected perspectives. I prefer how my life unfolds when I come at it in the moment with direct observation and those qualities. And
right.
And that's all you need, right? Because this isn't about tearing down anybody or anything else. This is about, let's find out what works for me. Let's find out what I can tap into from my own higher guidance that will leave me with a set of circumstances that I highly prefer in life compared to what happens when I try and live according to what somebody else tells me I should be doing,
mm-hmm.
or what shoulds come out of any other tradition. Because traditions,
right.
thoughts, beliefs, they're all old, dead energies. They're not awake and aware and alive in the moment.
Right. So they're like fences around a sapling or something in hopes that the tree will...
Fences around what? You got soft there. Your volume went down.
Sorry. Fences around a sapling. And once the tree has established its roots, you can take the fence away. That's like the way church is, I suppose, for a while.
Well, that's what a lot of people say to, you know, keep perpetuating the church. But
yeah.
It isn't necessarily, you know, it isn't an essential ingredient to living respectfully and lovingly and with your eyes open in the moment. That's what a lot of people
totally
say.
Agree.
Oh, I needed this. I had to have these roots. And that's not necessarily the case.
Oh, I agree totally. But if you do it and you don't stop in there and just stay stuck inside the fence and then tell the whole outside world, unless you're in here, you're going to hell, you leave that if you went in at all. Anyway.
Well, it's the idea of, you know, that Paul Simon puts in one of his songs, you know, when I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all.
That's just right. Yeah.
And, and you know, I'm sure that he got that wisdom from other writers over time who've talked about how long it took them to recover from their education.
Right. That's a great way to put it.
So I just want to, you know, highlight the fact that what Timothy Freke and Peter Gandy are doing in their books is about shining a light on the way things actually were, and that's not an attack on anyone or anything. It's just, right? It's like when I was in school, I heard all about how General George Armstrong Custer was such a magnificent hero. And then when I got out of college, people had started writing some books about the truth. And it didn't look anything like the fake history that we'd been told was the truth of life. And so that wasn't attacking anybody. That's just saying, hey, wait a minute. You've been told this story that's completely false. How would you like to hear, you know, what really happened and what was really going on? And if you're willing to hear that, if you're willing to hear that, then you have a whole different set of options for how you live your life and how you, who you're going to put on a pedestal, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, I need to back up a second. You said Timothy Freak
and Peter Gandy
are telling it the way it really was. That's actuality. And I think that's one of my questions that I wasn't even aware of is that actuality? Do they have an interest in...
I don't know, but it's what they've come up with by not just taking the religious story and actually digging into the history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like what Joseph Campbell did. You're familiar with Joseph Campbell and how he wrote about all of these different cultures and religious traditions and how they're based on things that went, you know, eons before them. But so many of them want to claim that they have the one true story.
Right.
And so Joseph Campbell said, okay, you can believe that if you want, but here's another culture, you know, 2,000-3,000 years earlier on another continent from an entirely different language and culture that had the same story.
Yeah.
It had all the same components.
Yep.
It's like, you know, it's like what Timothy Freak and Peter Gandy do in unraveling the Jesus story and how Mithras and Dionysus and all of these other characters had all the same components.
Yeah.
12 disciples, the wedding, water into wine, the walking on water, the crucified,
the
died and buried, and resurrected 3 days later. And,
yeah.
And that those stories in these other cultures predated what was listed as the one true story in the Jesus story. And people trying to defend that went so far as to say, well, this is just the devil. This is Satan. And here's how tricky Satan was. Satan wanted you to not believe in the truth of Christ, and so Satan went back in time thousands of years and made up these stories and had these cultures believing the false of the truth. It's absolutely bizarre. So people will do whatever they need to do to believe whatever they need to believe. And do Timothy Freak and Peter Gandy have all the answers? No. And have they been shining a light on some of the historical facts that excuse me a minute, somebody just texted, and occasionally when I have this it's related to the internet show we're doing, as you know, because you've texted me sometimes from that. Somebody's asking the Laughing Jesus. Yes, this is The Laughing Jesus by Timothy Freak and Peter Gandy is the book. So
they're telling you that, or you're writing
that's a text message. Somebody was asking me what's the book we're referring to. It's The Laughing Jesus by Timothy Freak and Peter Gandy.
Yeah,
Okay.
So, you know, but these are people who are not trying to get you to join their group. They're not trying to get you to tithe to them. They're not trying to get you to believe anything. They're just sharing the results of extensive research they've done. That's available. Anybody can do that research. And so do with it whatever you want.
Well, I am so far. I wanted to ask a favor. You've read the whole thing, right?
Yes.
I've got a couple of other books I'm champing at the bit to get to. So my tendency is to just, I'm going to put it on the shelf and not finish this. I get it. They're telling me basically, and I'll never remember all the stuff they said anyway. Is there something in there that I really should read before? I mean, I noticed they have some exercises at the back, some meditations. Are those worth looking at? Do you have a feeling about that?
I don't think that they're any more relevant than the work you're getting through Dr. Michael Rice's work and what you've done with it.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't imagine it was. Okay. Or anything else. I usually finish books, but I only read at night before going to sleep, and usually I'm so pooped by the time I get in bed, I get 10 minutes of reading, and that's it. So I parse out. I'm pretty careful about what I'm reading. So I thought, is it worth it to finish this book? I have a new friend here who's an Old Testament scholar, researcher, lecturer, although she's retired now. We've been going for walks, and I've been thinking, should I tell her about this book? Anyway, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know her well enough to know whether her faith is dependent upon the actual existence of Jesus as a man who walked around on the planet. I'll wait a little while, I guess.
That's a heavy sigh. As though it's a really, yeah. It's like it's a real, real big decision. Like you could make or break that person's life by giving them a book title. So
or at
that,
least
I just want to point out to
the...
you that it. Well, I just want to point out to you that the heavy sigh is indicative to me that you're putting a lot of value on this and making it be a real big thing. And I would just say, you know what? You don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to make it such a big deal. It's
all
a
right.
book.
Well, no. Well, it is a big deal, and it's amazing to me that I feel so darn cheerful in spite of reading it. I feel as if I've found a truth beneath what all that was that I thought I was depending on and now don't feel I need.
That probably feels pretty good to you.
It does.
Okay. Then do more of that.
and
let it be okay because you're choosing to do it because it's working for you. And don't think that anybody else has to choose it in order for you to be happy or that anybody else has to approve of you doing it for you to be happy. Just understand that, hey, this feels pretty good. I think I'll do some more of this and see where this takes me.
Well, that leads into my second thing is I can't wait till you get going on this DNRS thing if you're going to do it. And it's way early for me to be talking to you about it because I'm only 4 days in and I'm probably on a honeymoon. But one of the most amazing parts of the exercise, the steps are very interesting. They feel very contrived. They're like Tai Chi with a verbal component. They've got these slow motions that go with statements as you move around on different plaques that you put on the floor. And I've done away with those already. The cats push them all around and the dog walks on them. And I'm just remembering what they are and I just walk around on my rug. But there are two components at the end of it. One is to go into a memory way back. Probably, but not necessarily. In my case, it's way back. And then a second 10 or 15 minute stretch of imagining a future that I want And being almost 80 years old, I have to be pretty expedient about that because I don't really, anyway, I have a lot of feelings about getting really decrepit. I'd like to be able to do it in the next 5 or 10 years at the most time. But the memory part, I thought, well, I'll remember we used to live in this one room, literally a shack on the water on Cape Cod, and I've talked about it before, I'm sure, right on the water, uninhabited beach. Then some friends came and built a house with my dad's help about, you know, an eighth of a mile in one direction, and people started settling in, but houses far apart and very simple. And we had running salt water. We didn't have electricity. We had oil lamps at night. We'd go to bed when it got dark. We had partitions, Indian blankets. We'd pull across these partitions, and they didn't even go to the ceiling. So it was one big room partitioned off, and we slept in army bunk beds. And for some reason down there, my sister and I never fought, and my mother never whipped us. She didn't even bring the whip with her. It was like during the summer, it's very different, and it's the greatest, most wonderful life. Get up in the morning, you're barefoot all day, put on whatever you need, and it's usually just a one-piece something or other, and you're out the door, and you're out all day except for getting a glass of water or having a sandwich in the middle of the day. And the things we found to do when there was, quote, nothing to do was amazing. I don't remember ever being bored, but my happiest memory of my whole life, I think, was on Friday afternoon. My dad would have packed the car. It was an old Plymouth station wagon. He worked in Boston. He'd have the car packed. He'd go to work in Boston. As soon as he got out of work, he would drive to the Cape, and we would walk to meet him. And we would walk probably about 2 miles, but we'd take it very slowly, one dirt road, another dirt road, then a vaguely paved road, then another paved road. I remember so much about it and how excited we were that he was coming. And then we'd see his car coming along, bouncing along, lots of dips in the road. And he'd pick us up, and we'd get in this car, and no seat belts, and the seats were fat, bouncy vinyl seats, and he'd bounce us home. And we'd have to make our way through deep ruts in the sandy road because the road filled with water, high tide. It was impassable during high tides. But it would be low tide most of the time. He'd park somewhere and wait. But he knew how to just gun the engine and swerve through these deep sandy ruts until we ended up in front of it was a homothode garage he built. It was just this box. And we'd get Daddy there. And for some reason, I go over and over this memory, and I feel so well and so happy and so healthy doing it that I'm thinking, This is neural pathway reestablishing and rewiring. And, you know, you said don't preach to people about what you're doing, but I would suggest if you didn't do this program, you just do that part of it. It is so fun. And you come up with more and more details, more and more things to remember. And so I feel as if I'm doing my rewiring in a very messy way because I don't have an hour at a time usually that's uninterrupted, even the radio show, you know, I'm running around doing. But
so what you mean to say is...
yeah. Okay, sorry, that was a little long-winded.
That you do not take an hour at a time.
No.
Without... filling it with other distractions and activities.
I usually get about 20 minutes, and so I've been doing it in increments.
No, it's not. It's not get. It's not get. It's what you take. You are filling your time
mm-hmm.
you're choosing distractions as opposed to focused time.
And oh, quiet, Dr. Tim. That is
no,
so
no,
true,
no, no, no.
And I don't want to.
I can't not say the truth. It isn't wise nor safe to go against my conscience.
Shoot. Yep, I'm choosing to allow interruptions because
you're not allowing, you're making. You're choosing how you spend your time. This is what the Way of Mastery has us just waking up to. And it's okay. You know, I had somebody in my office just earlier today, and she was talking about how she's created this sense of belief that her greatest value in life is as a mother, and that's what gives her life value, et cetera. And I said, that's okay. You can do that. Or you could choose to use cocaine or heroin or any other drug to distract you from the fact that you don't feel very good about yourself at a core level. It's okay. Mm. It's your choice. How you want to live your life. This is what we're doing. This is what the Way of Mastery calls us to pay attention to. Whatever we spend our mind energy on, whatever we spend our time, intelligence, and money on, is what we value. And it's how we're communicating to the world what we truly value. And what you're communicating is you truly value distraction and multitasking and, you know, skimming the surface while talking about depth. And it's okay. It's what's working for you at a certain level.
Well, maybe it isn't at a certain level.
Well,
you know what?
Right,
I want to fight with you about this for just a second. I'm in my room with the door open. Because I have two cats who don't like closed doors. So I leave it a little bit open. And, of course, they come in, and I pay attention to them. I don't just ignore them, because if I do, they'll make a ruckus. Now, I'm nice to my cats. Now, so talk me through that. Really?
I don't need to talk you through it. If you want to believe that that's your life and that there's no other way, that's fine. That's what you want to believe, and that's what you'll pour your energy into. I'm not trying to tell you how to live your life.
You have a cat?
I'm just trying to tell you what the teaching is, that the Way of Mastery and Course in Miracles and Guy Finley and Michael Rice and all these other things would say, this is something you might want to observe for yourself, that I don't know how many times I've heard Michael Rice say so many times over the years. You know, people say, oh, I don't have time to do, you know, worksheets. Or he talks about the tithing. And he says, you know, tithing is not just about giving 10% of your money to the church. It's about 10% of your time and intelligence, money and energy, and giving it to whatever nourishes you, nurtures you, supports you. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, et cetera. And so 10% of your time, if there is a 24-hour day, 10% of your time is 2.4 hours that you should be spending doing your work, doing whatever is advancing your spiritual life. And people say, oh, I couldn't afford that. I can't do that. And he says, okay, then if you really want to make progress, you rearrange your life. And if you're not so focused on making progress, you leave your life the way it is, or you get even more distracted. But it is an option for everybody. That's like, you know, the Way of Mastery is one of the lessons is you need do nothing. And you have choice. If you needed to do X, Y, or Z thing, that would mean you don't have choice. And you don't have free will. It's just the teaching. It isn't necessarily the absolute truth, et cetera. It's just what the teaching says, and it's my job as part of the, you know, moderator of this internet show to pay attention to that and repeat it so people can observe it for themselves.
Okay, you're on to something really interesting. I've been asking myself, I heard what you said, and I'm going to ask you a question about my son, who's probably felt worse than he's ever felt. And he makes promises about sticking around, but he doesn't want to. He feels as if he has nothing to live for. It's a terrible depression right now. So I visit him occasionally and we talk. And one of my thoughts is, you got to do the DNRS program. And I'm thinking, no, he's probably not up for that. But, and he would, in a way, he's just like me. He's choosing not to do it or do whatever it would take to be okay. I feel as if I'm doing a lot to be okay, and I feel as if I am mostly really okay. But there's something about what I'm doing that he's doing too, and I have to just let him do what he's doing. And you're letting me do what I'm doing, although you're informing me about all these other things.
It is one of the things that we observe that says we do have free will. Despite, you know, this scientist recently who came out and wrote a book and articles about how we don't have free will, et cetera, and here's how we... But you can choose. And as you choose, you create your experience of life. And that is the core teaching in the Way of Mastery. It's also the core teaching in the Course in Miracles. It's the core teaching in Guy Finley's work, where he says, as goes my attention, so comes my experience. And so it's the good news / bad news, depending upon how you want to interpret it, right? I'm the one that's created every upset I've ever experienced. Boy, that's a rough thing to hear. But it's also a really good thing to hear. If I step in and recognize, hey, I'm the one that's doing it and I don't like it, that means I can stop doing it or I can start doing something else instead. And, of course, we have to step in quickly for a lot of people and say, all right, notice how your mind might want to go to, I'm to blame, or you're telling me I'm doing it all wrong. And there's nothing about you're to blame or you're doing anything wrong in this teaching.
Okay.
That comes from your conditioning and from the pattern of, you know, being conditioned into judgment that comes from whatever your cultural upbringing is.
Yeah.
This work just says, it's okay. Choose what you want to choose. And you can always wake up and recognize you're the one choosing it. And you can also spend your time deciding to blame, you know, anyone or anything else around you, and then you get to play the role of victim. And that's okay, too, if you want to, you know, you don't want to. But if you're going to do that, that's okay. It's a tough nut to swallow for a lot of people who've been conditioned and raised with a belief that accepting responsibility for something means blame and guilt and shame, rather than having it be a tool I can use. And as I pick up that tool, then it leaves me open to have the ability to respond differently the next time a similar situation arises.
What you said about being a victim.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't feel as if I'm a victim to my cats. I'm glad to see them. I don't understand why it's necessarily a victim thing.
Well, just think of the phrasing and the meaning we have given these words when I say, I don't have an hour of uninterrupted time. I can't find, etc. It just means it's happening to me, and I don't have any choice in the matter. And so my talking to you about how it is a choice as soon as we wake up and realize it. It's just about observation. It's not about a judgment. It's just about saying, okay, mm-hmm. So what you're choosing to do is spend your time loaded with all kinds of multitasking and other activities. That's okay. I just flashed on the, like most of the people who are highly successful
mm-hmm.
will say at one, I mean really highly successful, will say at one level or another how important meditation is in their lives
mm-hmm.
and in their productivity. And most of the people who are nowhere near as productive as them will say, I don't have time for meditation.
I get it, yeah.
Right? And so
right.
I can't find the time. Well, I've said this a number of times over the years on the internet show because it's something I've learned from my best teachers over the years. I will never find the time. I'll never find a free hour. Oh, my God, look what I just found, a whole free hour. I'm never going to find that. That's mm-hmm. not going to happen. And yet, on any given day, I can choose to take an hour to do something.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be a very big experiment. That's good. Okay.
It reminds
right,
me
well,
of the
anybody...
story of Mary Baker Eddy, and I know I've told this story before, but she had one of her top, executives helping her run the church and build the building and do the Christian Science Monitor, the newspaper that was world-renowned.
Oh, yeah.
And they decided they needed to expand the mother church and do some renovations and whatnot. And it was just, at one point, in her work, she had, and her model was that anybody that worked for her had to do their own meditation and prayer. They had to be doing their own work,
mm-hmm.
tapping into their own guidance. And so I don't know whether it was an hour or 2 hours a day that, was recommended that these people do their prayer and meditation. And this gentleman came to her and said, I hate to do this to you. I know how important this is, but he said, I am just so burned out. I just can't do it. There's too much going on, too many demands on my time. And she said, okay, well, if you really need to, I'll accept your resignation. She said, and you might want to try doubling your meditation before you resign.
Whoa.
And he said, aren't you listening to anything I'm talking about? I just finished telling you I don't have enough time for blah, blah, blah. And she said, yes, I heard you. And I'll be happy to accept your resignation if that's what you choose. And you might want to choose, before you decide that, you might want to just double your meditation and prayer and then decide. Well,
great story.
The story is that he did just that. He doubled his meditation time and he came back and said, I don't need to resign. I'm getting more done. I have plenty of energy. Thank you for the recommendation, etc.
Mm.
And so that goes hand in hand with the idea that most of the really successful people that you'll read their stories and they say meditation is a key part of their productivity and their energy mm-hmm. level, etc. Wow. I can't even imagine that. Well, it's because if I don't make time for it, then I'm more frazzled. I'm using that same time for other things that are mm-hmm. not regenerative, right? For other
yeah.
things that drain my energy in one way or another, or
mm-hmm.
or are using, I need to use a certain amount of my time, intelligence, money, and energy for this or that activity, whether it's, watching movies on Netflix or scrolling Facebook or shopping for things that, I don't really need or whatever it is.
Mm.
And I'm using the time. The time is there in the day, right? Everybody's got the same 24 hours in a day as we mark time on this planet. So I could be using it for meditation and prayer, or I could be using it for whatever else I do with my time. And we got into this because I was just trying to highlight for you, you were making a statement about how you don't have a free hour, as though, mm-hmm. you know, somebody would wrap it up and give it to you as a gift. And I'm just trying to highlight, that's not the way the system works. Each one of us decides how we spend the time in our waking time in our day. And for the most part,
sense.
It's not done to us or given to us. It's what we choose
mm-hmm.
to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're trained to think in terms of there's not enough time in the day, and, oh, I'm so busy, and, oh, I'm so stressed, and that's how we're trained to think about it. And so that's how we create our experience. We create an experience of being overly booked and having too many demands on our time and not being able to find the time to do this and that, as though we're going to stumble across the time. Like finding, you know, a diamond as you're walking along a riverbed, or a lump of gold or something. But that's not the way time actually works in our lives.
You know, Dr. Kim, this is what I'm thinking is, okay, I could take that hour, but I would have to be a real bitch to do it. I'd have to say, you know.
You are going to cling to that, boy, I tell you, because nobody wants you to be a real bitch. Your cats don't want it. Nobody here on the radio show wants it. I'm sure your husband doesn't want it. You better not do it, Sue.
Right. I know. I'm riding this thing with you and telling you all the resistances. I have a husband who gets up at 4:30 or 5. He goes right into his study and shuts the door. And I bring him, at his request, 20 ounces of lemon water, hot, first thing. So I bring that to him. And then all these other things that are similar. If I really wanted to take an hour at 4:30 or 5 to 6, I could do that. But I would really be imposing on other people or animals. I know
that,
I'm
that's
making...
Just,
I know,
that's a lovely set of excuses you've created there, and I encourage you to use them as long as they're working for you.
Touche. You're being too good at this. In fact, you're being almost mean, but I understand what you're saying. I get it. I do get it. I'll get up at 3 a.m. and be a martyr and give myself that hour. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I hope so. That's kind of silly.
Yeah. All right, well, this has been very interesting. So I don't have to break up the hour. Well, at my choice, because I'm so itchy. I'm doing 20 minutes, 20 minutes, and 20 minutes. And she said, any Hopper, who is the founder of the NRS program, says that is fine, and I can do that. That's it for the moment. Maybe it'll expand.
It's absolutely fine, and it'll get even more fine as you realize that it's what you're choosing and that you have choice in the matter.
Okay.
Because then... And then you have the option to move into results rather than excuses.
Well, it isn't an either-or thing. I'm getting results, too.
I just flashed on the Guy Finley story where there's these aspirants at a school. And they're there, they're going through all kinds of, you know, communal and individual things. But the school is held on the shores of this bog. And in the center of the bog is this island. And there's this hill on this island. And the idea is if you can make it across the bog of, you know, the black bog of desolation to the island and climb the hill, then you find this little cup that's full of this juice and you drink it and you get your next phase of enlightenment. And of course, the students build all kinds of community and camaraderie over the years, and they're working really hard and different trials and things. But the big trial is to get to the island. And so one day, this student makes it to the island and comes back. Clearly, everybody knows he's made it because he's radiant, he's calm, he's, you know, he's gotten more beautiful, whatever. And so, as you might imagine, what happens with the other students is they're not exactly thrilled for his success. You cheated. You know, what did you do? How did you get? It's impossible to cross the bog, et cetera. And he had a roommate, and his roommate was, you know, chiding him one evening, and he said, "Hey, come on now, I'll show you. I'll show you what. Just come on." So he goes out, and he just starts walking, and he's walking right across the top of the bog. He's not sinking, and. His roommate sees this and says, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And he takes a couple steps out. And he's like, oh, my God, I'm doing it. And a few more steps out. And all of a sudden, he starts to sink. And he's starting to sink, and he's up to his knees, and then he's up to his waist, and he's crying out to his, oh, my God, help me, help me. And his roommate takes a couple steps back and says, you know, all you have to do is drop your excuses. What are you talking about? You found something I haven't found. And the guy says, listen, all you have to do is quit holding on to your excuses. And it's the story of our lives right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we believe we can't, we're right. If we believe we can, we're right. That's been attributed to Henry Ford. And, you know, if you believe you can or you believe you can't, you're right. Either way, what you believe in, you're going to make happen. You're going to make, right. And that's what the Way of Mastery is saying over and over again. What you believe in and pour your mind energy into is going to create your experience in this life.
Mm. Well, you have just bored slightly a deeper hole in my understanding. I mean that as I didn't. It sounds as if I'm trying to insult you. No, I get it. That's very good.
Well, it is. It's a huge lesson for most of us in the Western world to pay attention to that. We are taught to believe that we do not have control over our time, ability to say yes or no, you know, that we aren't the authors of our experience. And it's like Michael Rice has said for years, you know, if people say to him, oh, I couldn't tithe toward my spiritual growth. I couldn't give 2.4 hours a day with all the stuff I have to do in my life. And he said, well, then you need to rearrange your life. And then people say, oh, I can't. And he says, okay. And yet, time and time again, people do. And they get the results that they put the effort into getting, for the most part, without us realizing it most of the time. You know, we are actively creating the results we're getting, and we're not sure how or why. So that's why it's valuable to begin questioning this stuff at deeper and deeper levels. So that's what we're hoping to do when you make a statement like, you know, I just don't, my life doesn't allow me to have an uninterrupted hour. Okay. Perhaps that's true, and perhaps it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to be just a very nice bitch. I think it'll work if I just am pleasant about it.
Well, and of course, you don't have to give it that label. Have you labeled your husband a selfish bastard?
Sometimes.
For taking that time?
No, but when he said, you know, I mean, I'm in there doing my steps, and he'll call and say, Sue, quick, I'm having trouble with my computer. So I leave my practice, and I go in there. Now,
okay,
I
but
can
that,
say
that's
to him,
a choice you're making. Yes, you could set this up with him in advance that says, listen, you have your time, I have mine. I'll be happy to help you when my time's finished, et cetera.
Right, and I'm going to do that. You wait, Dr. Tim. I'll give you a report.
I'll look forward to it. I'm, you know, the idea is just to observe and question for yourself. It's not to live into what you think Dr. Tim is telling you you should do.
No, it makes sense. I like it. It's good. I feel as if I wander off the track a lot, and you get all of us back on the track. Probably not just me. Just being reminded of the obvious stuff that you've been saying from the beginning.
Well, I think most people who've stepped into it have found that, oh boy, I was living in this belief that I didn't have time and I couldn't make the time and I had to wait until I found the time, et cetera. And when I step into a different set of observations and a different actual pattern of how I'm using the time I have, I get very different results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's just an invitation. It's what Way of Mastery is calling us to. It's what Michael Rice for years in his work has been calling people to as he's talking about setting out your primary and secondary purpose and deciding to pursue something that actually lights a fire for you, gives you energy as you expend your energy and gives you a sense of purpose in life that is rewarding at different levels. And he's, you know, it's just what we're offering people is the observation. You can try it for yourself or not. So I will thank you for your time. As always, it's great to have you.
For yours.
Commenting and questioning, and I will mute you so you can listen to the second hour. And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Good conversation.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio, and today is Thursday, April 18th, 2024, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. And give Michael just a moment to dial in, and I'll share with everybody. Yesterday, Aria took us through 7 minutes of a meditation and a stretch, and it was awesome. And I'll probably set it as an audio and put it out for people to listen to. And it was phenomenal, the information that she came up with automatically. She would say, you know, breathe in and breathe out constantly. And at one point she said, reach up like you're reaching to the rainbow and grab the breath and bring it down to your lap. And now taste the breath and breathe in and breathe out. I mean, it was just awesome just to participate in that with her. And the knowing that she has, that's beyond her years. It's just amazing. I'm not sure where she gets everything. It's just automatic for her. And that was enjoyable to spend that 7 minutes with her. And she probably could have gone on another 30 minutes, but she needed to get going to go to ballet. And so we had to cut it short. But anyway, it is there within all of us. It's just that most of the time we don't listen. And I think she's getting intuitive guidance as, you know, she goes along and just her imagination is full and free. And it's great to be a part of that. And Michael's not with us yet. I'm going to start Podbean. Welcome, Sandy, to Podbean. And if you've missed part of the shows, not all of them have been out of the Enlightenment book, but you can go to our website, and under Kaboris, you can click on Enlightenment Study. And we've got where you can go to our YouTube channel and listen to it, or you can go to Podbean and listen to it. And I'll also remind you again, I said yesterday, we've created shorts, which are 30 to 60 seconds long on our Facebook page, or not Facebook, I'm sorry, on our YouTube channel. And you can get to the YouTube channel either by typing in youtube.com/Michael Rice, or you can go to our website, and up in the top there is a link to YouTube, and if you click it, it'll take you directly there. So I am going to step away for just a second and see if Michael's having any technical issues. I'll be right back. I am back. And if you have a question, whether it's pertaining to the Enlightenment or anything else, please press 1, let us know, or you can drop me an email at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at yagain.org. And we do have a question from Michael Tatey. Whenever Michael gets on, I will read the question, and we will address that. So give him just a moment. And we thank you for being with us. Thank you for your patience. And I hope that the recording came through okay. It was a little challenging to hear Jamuna on the Podbean. It was really a quiet connection. So I'm not sure how that works, but I'm glad that we have the opportunity and the means to have a connection with people in other countries that can't just call in. And this, you know, Podbean, you have to download the app to your phone, and you can click that you follow us. Now, it'll show up, because it is a podcast program, it'll show up that there are two Mindshifters radios. One of them, it's picking up from Blog Talk, and that one's got our picture on it. And then the one that has a glowing heart is actually the Podbean podcast. And if you click on that and say that you're following us, it will actually send you an email or a text and let you know that we are live. And you can, when you dial in there on your phone, you're not having to use cell minutes or anything, as long as you have internet connection. And you can either chat in the chat room there, or you can press the little telephone icon down at the bottom, and it will let me turn your microphone on in Podbean, and we can talk to you. Like I said, for some reason, and I don't know if it's on the other end, I believe that Jamuna said that if you didn't have it on hands-free, if you had it just on the speaker, put your headset in or whatever, it is louder, so that works better than if you've got your phone on hands-free. It makes it a little bit louder so we can hear you. And Michael's with us, so I'm going to say, welcome, Michael. I was just telling them while I was waiting for you to get in about our meditation with Aria yesterday.
And that was so awesome.
Yeah, and perhaps I can turn it into an audio where people can hear it. But welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gearheart, and welcome, everybody. Glad we get to play again. And move forward, had a question come up. Would you like to read the question, sweetie?
Sure. So it's from Michael Tatey, and he says, Michael, could you expound on the statement from a couple of shows ago where you talked about fear and hostility being a mental illness? Am I recalling that correctly? Assist me back to the point if not. And if so, I would like to have more information on how and why that is. In other words, how your fear and hostility should be classified as a mental illness. And not from a doubting standpoint, but wishing to comprehend this more completely. And how would I present this concept to others with demonstration to solidly relay the information in a reasonable format?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Present it to people very carefully because it's probably going to resonate some things for people. And for me, the best way to understand that one is through an analogy. So let's imagine that I have a diesel automobile. It runs on diesel fuel. And if I pull up to the pump, now fortunately, the diesel pump won't, the nozzle on it won't fit into a regular car, but let's imagine that it did, and I filled my car up. You know, let's say the tank is empty. I filled my car up with regular gasoline. What's going to happen? My car isn't going to go very far. It's going to be diseased. It's going to have a fuel disease, i.e., it's going to quit running, and it's going to take some repairs, some, you know, some money to get it back on track again. Gas tank's going to be cleaned out. Fuel lines are going to be cleaned out. Let's see. I forget exactly how the fuel is distributed in a diesel engine. I think it's just a pressure nozzle, if I remember correctly. It's a little different than gasoline. But anyway, so we would say that the car, if we used a disease analogy, the car has a fuel disease. So my offering is, after years of working with people and realizing that the only time that people are sane is when they get back to a mind fueled by love. When the mind gets back on track, gets connected into that space of love, then all of the raging and crazy stuff that's going on with humanity disappears. And actually, I started to use this idea just privately for myself as it dawned on me that hostility and fear are a mental illness. And, you know, with our analogy with the car and the diesel fuel, your mind, my mind, is designed to run on the energy of our original essence, which I offer is love. If you can verify that for yourself just by holding a newborn child and tapping into the essence of the newborn. And, you know, having asked tens of thousands of people over the years between Jeannie and I the question and gotten answers from those people, and it doesn't matter what culture we're in, everybody's answer is always the same. Some variation on the theme of love is the descriptor that they use for the newborn. So I'm offering that that's the energy that our minds are designed to run on. When it first occurred to me that hostility and fear might be a mental illness, I started to use that idea just with myself. When I'd find myself in some sort of hostility or have a fear-based thought come up, I'd say to myself, this is my mental illness. And what I found was that it was a whole lot easier to shift away from it when I realized it was a mental illness rather than something that would be useful or helpful for me. And so if the mind is fueled by hostility and fear, it never works properly. It never gives us constructs. And remembering that, you know, perception is a construct of the mind, it never gives us constructs that are sane. Hostility and fear, when fueling a human mind, turns perception into deception. And so as we called the diesel engine trying to run on gasoline, having a fuel disease, the mind running on thoughts based in hostility or fear has a mental illness. So that would be my take on it. And, you know, for me, the verification of it came personally for me, and then I've gotten verification from a few people who've gone, yeah, that's a way that I've really caught myself and been able to be inspired to correction rather than holding on to my fear or hostility-based thoughts, is to recognize that my mind isn't working properly. And if it's not working properly, obviously the average person is going to go for, what do I need to do to correct it? What do I need to do to get that thing back on track? And what I need to do to get back on track is reconnected to love. So that's my take. And if you happen to be with us, Michael, and that leads to any thoughts, then please push one. Let's have a conversation about it. So we're on page 80 on the in the Enlightenment book in the dictionary. And if you look halfway down the page, the word liba, and this is part of where that insight came, is an Aramaic word that's a noun, and it speaks of the source of our thinking. In Aramaic, it's called the heart. Or pardon me, in Greek, it's called the heart. So the Greeks translated it as heart. But it's more properly, in Aramaic, the mind. And if we go back to Yeshua, it's like just a number of things added up to make sense of this for me, and then the practical application just cemented it. When you hear Yeshua and they ask him, what's most important in the law? And defining the word law properly in Aramaic has nothing to do with the rule of a superior, as the Greek mind would tell us. There's some superior that sets up laws and you better obey. There's no obedience to law. There's no such thing as breaking a law. The word law in Aramaic simply means the way things work. You can't break the way things work. If you do things that produce danger and hostility and fear and rage and guilt and conflict in your life, you're working by the laws of danger and fear and guilt and conflict in your life. But the question was, what do we do to true, you know, the essence of the question to me is, what do we do to really function as human beings? And he says, not love your neighbor, not love the Creator as yourself. But he says, have the condition of rachma active in your mind. And rachma is a filter and a gateway over intentions. The gateway being, when it's open, the energy of love is what fuels your mind. If it's closed, and it will be closed by the activity of any form of hostility or fear, then you don't have a human life working properly, and therefore, and the reason for that is because the mind is not working properly. Therefore, my conclusion that it's a mental illness. And I'll take 100% responsibility for this conclusion. I've never heard it anywhere else. I've never had anybody even start to reference it as that. But to me, it just makes perfect sense and really serves me to be able to acknowledge the truth to myself if I'm in some form of hostility or fear. You know, one of the most difficult things for a mind to do when it's in hostility or fear is to discern even what the truth is. So that's my input on that question. And as I say, yeah, in many circles, you're going to want to be very careful, because you're going to be probably talking to dysfunctional minds, and what dysfunctional minds tend to do is attack when they're confronted with things they don't like. So that's my thought on how to present the idea. And, you know, for me, it would depend on what context I'm in. Obviously, I would lay a foundation, you know, if I were going into, and in fact, you know, I don't travel the way that I used to, but I used to just about every Sunday be doing a Sunday presentation somewhere, and I could easily see myself doing a 30 to 45 minute presentation on a mind fueled by hostility and fear is a mind that is in mental illness. I could easily see myself doing that as a message. And with the uplift that the goal is to recognize that if I'm disconnected from my source, it's like, there's an early worksheet and the question was, what's the real problem here? The real problem is I made something be more important than being connected to my source. Now, that's an idea that was in the worksheet 40 years ago. It took me, and maybe I'm a slow learner, it took me that long to get to recognize, when I'm disconnected from my source, I'm stuck in a mental illness. And I need to be cleaning my mind up in order to be, and also the extension of that is because the body is the mind and the mind is the body, because they are simply flip sides of exactly the same coin, whatever happens in the mind happens in the body. If someone is in hostility or fear, they have a physical disease. On the level where we believe in physical. Now, if we listen to Einstein, Einstein says on such things as matter, we've been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. Matter does not exist. We don't live in a material world. We live in an energetic world. But our brain makes things that aren't solid look like they're solid. And let's use an example. Imagine that I clap my hands together. This would be the objection that I've gotten from people when I tell them that there is no matter and there is no body. Look, I just clapped my hands together and one hand stopped the other. Obviously, they're solid. Well, no, that doesn't make it obvious that they're solid. What it does mean, when you have the brain cells for it, what clapping your hands together and they stop each other, what that means is that energy fields who have similar resonant atomic magnetic structures create interference patterns with each other. But let's imagine that I make my left hand out of radio waves and I clap my hands together. What happens? My left hand passes right through my right hand. Obviously, my right hand was not solid. If I make my right hand out of the same radio waves, then they would appear solid to each other again. But there's nothing solid about a radio wave. We understand that. In exactly the same way, there's nothing solid about your hand. They're just similar atomic magnetic structures that create interference patterns with each other. So we have this energy field, and my background is electronics with a side study in physics, and when I first heard the teachings of Yeshua in his native Aramaic language, what started to become very clear to me in a very shorter order, and of course I had the brain cells for this field, as Yeshua says, you can't really use or understand anything he has to say unless you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. Well, my brain cells were locked in on physics when I got out of school. And when I started hearing things like, in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh from Einstein. And then I hear in the opening words in the book of John in Aramaic, where we're told it says in the beginning was the word and the word became flesh. But what it really says in Aramaic is in the beginning was the mind energy. The mind energy became flesh. Then we start to realize that, there is this organizing factor called thought. And that organizing factor organizes, break that word down, turns into organic structure, what we call a body. Now, we tend to, in fact, there's a time back, 1600s, I think, where the church and, scientific mind who came up with the thought, I think, therefore I am. It's like, cycling information in brain cells is not thinking, but if you think that's thinking, then you might think that's what proves that you are, but not really. And So the church wanted to hold on to the mind, the soul, and, you know, so science went with the body, and they created a false division. But what we call the body and what we call the mind are literally different perspectives on exactly the same structure. I was going to say object, but it's actually not an object. You know, if I took let's say I've got a silver dollar and on one side, but I've got George Washington's head, and on the other side of it, there's an eagle. And I show that to two different people. One person sitting on my left says, oh, that's George Washington. The person sitting on my right says, oh, that's an eagle. And show them that it's a coin, and they go, oh. So we have a singular object and two perspectives on that object. From one perspective, it looks like one thing. From another perspective, it looks like the other. But it is neither. It's a coin. You know, and at what point can I take the head off of the coin and leave only the tail? Can I do that? No, it's impossible. I don't have the original object if I take the head off of the coin. Let's imagine I get a saw fine enough to cut it in two. I still have what we call the flip side of the coin, a head side and a tail side. It just doesn't have the image on it. What I've taken off of it is the image. Well, in precisely the same way, at what point can you take the mind away from the body or the body away from the mind? It's impossible. They are simply flip sides of exactly the same coin. One structure seen from two different perspectives. And so if I have a mental illness of hostility or fear, the tissue in which that energy of that mental illness is resident and vibrating is going to create a literal dis-ease in the tissue. And when I remove, that is, I forgive the dis-ease energy, that which interferes with the functioning of the tissue, then the tissue goes back to health. There's the secret of what, you know, down through the ages, people have called Yeshua the great physician. Why? Because he knew, at least back then, what not too many people even started to suspect, that it was mind energy becoming flesh. And there were those things that created illness. Mental illness created physical illness. And, of course, at the same time, if we have a mental illness, we're going to tend to lose our sensibilities about what to do on what we call the physical side of life, i.e. with the mental illness, it might seem like a really good thing to take something that's got a very harsh taste because there's phosphoric acid in it, add some chemicals, add some sugar, and a little bit of flavoring, and drink two or three or six or ten of those a day. Somebody might go, that's a good thing. And having lost one sensibility, it won't be long before that person's probably going to have things like diabetes and kidney failure, because phosphoric acid and sugar are very acid-forming products. And in fact, you might remember, if you go back into the early 70s, there was a Time magazine cover, and Time had a picture of Lake Erie and said, Lake Erie is dead, one of the Great Lakes. Well, what made them say that Lake Erie was dead? Well, Lake Erie would not support fish any longer. The fish were dying off. Why not? There wasn't enough oxygen in the lake to support the fish living in it. They did some research. They tried to drug the lake. They tried to do all kinds of things. But what they finally had to do was change the pH of the lake. What they found was, and you'll remember that about the same time that was in Life magazine, you'll remember, I believe it was Life, it might have been Time. You'll remember that about that same time, in America, they made it illegal to put phosphoric acid in laundry detergent anymore. Why did they make it illegal to put phosphoric acid in laundry detergent? because people did their laundry and the phosphoric acid turned the water acidic. When the water was pumped out into the sewage systems or out into the streets, wherever it went, and the phosphoric acid from industrial sites pouring out of those industrial sites, the lake became acidic. Acidic fluids don't carry oxygen very well. In fact, an acidic fluid drives out oxygen. The oxygen carrying capacity is reduced significantly. And that's what happened to Lake Erie. When they got the pH back into balance, out of the acidic range into an alkaline range, then the lake was able to carry oxygen again, and the fish are doing just fine to this day. But if our mental disorder, because every mental disorder causes pain, is causing so much pain that we're willing to put phosphoric acid and sugar and several chemicals, a little bit of flavoring in it, and stick it in our mouths, all of a sudden the body of water, you know, somewhere between 75 and 90-plus percent of your structure is water, it gets too acidic, drives the oxygen out. Cells don't last very long. In fact, it was a physician back in the 30s, a German physician, and not thinking of his name offhand, but if you just Google Germany 1930s cancer and pH or acid alkaline, what he was able to do, he did experiments where he took healthy cells, turned the environment of the cells acidic, and those healthy cells became cancerous. When he flooded the cells with alkaline interstitial fluid, got rid of the acid, the cancer cells became healthy cells again. And one of the main things that causes this physiological device to become acidic is acid thinking. We've heard the statement, you know, he has an acrid tongue. What does that mean? He's acidic mind, acidic words. So when we confront something for what it is, I think we have a lot better chance of having acknowledged it, doing something different in order to change it. And I personally found when every time I had hostility or fear come up, I realized or I admitted to myself that my mind was not functioning properly. And I had a mental illness going on. It tremendously helped me to see those states for what they were and do something about it. And, of course, the main tool that we offer for folks to do something about it is a tool of forgiveness, which means removal, taking the mind energy that has become cellular chemistry that creates problems in the cell and removing it so the cell can go back to health. So I hope, Michael, that answer gives you a good insight into my thinking on it. And if there are any other questions, you know, drop a text. And or when you've got the time, let's create a conversation about it.
Was that man in Germany, Otto Warburg?
Warburg, yes.
And the gentleman you quoted earlier, the I Think Therefore I Am, was Rene Descartes?
Descartes, yes. Yeah, Descartes. Hey, I should have remembered it because I always refer to him as the man who put Descartes before the horse. Got it backward.
And you have a hand up.
Oh, great. Let's say hello.
Is Rex 517. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, everybody. It's actually Missy.
Well, welcome, Missy. Good to hear your voice. How are you, young lady?
Hi, everyone. Hi, Jeannie. My question is about if you could share your thoughts on the difference between sleep apnea and still point, which physiologically they're very similar. A person is not taking in oxygen. One is very good for you or helpful, and the other can be detrimental to your health. So I'm curious if you could share any insights about that.
Yeah, to me, they'd be on opposite ends of the spectrum. Sleep apnea happens when people are not breathing and basically go into a miniature state of suspended animation. There's because the body is not getting enough oxygen. The opposite side of the spectrum would be the still point, where my take is what allows the still point to happen is that because of the still point breath, one is breathing pretty continuously. Sleep apnea, the breath stops. One's breathing continuously and builds up a sufficient oxygen that the breath can stop for just a moment. And in that state, one goes into a superconductor state. Holding the breath is a resistance state. Now, if we go to the Aramaic, the word Satan means the resistor, one who misleads. And when one goes into resistance, to me, that would be the sleep apnea state. The opposite is true when one uses the breath properly in still point, that one goes into a superconductor state where the breath is not required because there's sufficient oxygen built up throughout the tissue structure that all resistance goes, and in that superconductor state, one can move through a ton of energetic dynamics, especially mind energy dynamics, that otherwise they've kept locked in and held via their resistance in tissue. And moving into the still point is kind of like being in super processor state and being able to move that energy through. That would be my best
take.
Does that make sense? Does that fit?
Yes.
Cool.
It does, although looking at it, sometimes it, or listening to it, sometimes it sounds the same of like withholding with breath, and then a big gasp for air. So I get that you're saying that they originate from a different place. They may look physiologically the same, but they're originating from one from resistance and lack and one from an abundance.
Right. And again, the sleep apnea is where someone's not in a still point, but rather has simply stopped breathing. For me, there's a difference between still point and stopping breathing. You know, if I just hold my breath, I'm not in still point. I mean, things are quiet, but I'm not in still point. It may sort of physically look the same, but it's anything but the same as like I've topped off my oxygen reserves and my breath can just let go and everything in me soften for a moment. Different state.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Anything else exciting going on in your life? Anything else to share? Lots of questions. We haven't talked in a long time.
It has been a while. Well, it's spring in Michigan. Finally, we've got some springtime weather, and we got a couple, three hives of bees, so now we've got beehives, and we're just
nice.
We're busy. I know. We're going to have honey, and yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Life is good. Yeah.
I'm with you. Well, one of the things we're enjoying about spring here, like this morning, when I made breakfast, I took, I think we had six large, like about from a to maybe a half inch to three quarter inch diameter, from 10 inches to 14 inch long asparagus, cut that up and put it in our breakfast dish this morning, just right out of the garden. And that's awesome. This is our third year.
Better than that.
Say again?
There's not much better than that, just going out and picking a meal from the garden or from the tree or from the bush. Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So that's a pretty nice aspect of spring. We're in our third year of having asparagus in the ground, and this is the first time we've harvested them. We've just been leaving them to grow and strengthen, and now they're coming up like, whoa.
Yeah, good. Good. Well, thank you for answering that question. I appreciate you.
And, Michael, they're delicious.
All right, your heart.
All right, bye now.
The two that I
had
awesome.
Rex, I did pick one for you, a couple, didn't I?
Yes, they were delicious. They were really sweet. I ate them all the way down to the very bottom, which I don't normally do.
Yeah, well, the commercial ones you can't really. The bottom gets like a rock, but these ones, I mean, even the very thickest part of them are still tender and juicy.
Yeah. While we're on the topic of asparagus, I had a conversation with a second cousin yesterday. Her husband, my cousin, died of cancer, bladder cancer, several years ago, and we got on the topic of food that supports the body, and she said that asparagus is a food that's known to support healing of cancer. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I had not heard of that.
Do you know if there's any truth to that?
It's not, well, I think, you know, virtually any actual raw organic food is going to contribute to healing, although, you know, there's that old thing about asparagus pea, and not, it doesn't happen with everybody, but people that it happens with, when you take a whiff of asparagus pea, it's obviously something toxic happening, so the fact that just eating asparagus can, an hour later, give you some very obvious signs of detox, it would make sense to that it would be healing.
Yeah. Hold on. Thank you.
We're not letting it get ahead of us. We're getting about 6 or 8 nice big spears a day right now and chowing
on. Right.
Yes, and glad you got to have a couple there while you were here, Rex.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Cool. All right, well, any other thoughts for either of you guys? How are you doing, Rex? Anything to share? Any questions, thoughts, answers, ideas?
I'm doing well. I really enjoyed I heard the last half of the program yesterday, and you resonated what I'd shared at the end of the program, that experience of Yeshua, you know, that I felt like I became him and I was on the cross. That's what the experience was, and my reasoning ability said, no, wait a minute. That's not what actually happened, but I tuned into a frequency, and I was sharing it with such love and clarity that the frequencies in my understanding blended, and then I resonated it, and I could feel it. And I think it's so important for all of us is to just to recognize the true oneness of our being and to be able to interact with each other based on that. I mean, spoke about that quite a bit at the beginning, I think, too. You know, so and whatever I can do to reaffirm that and to strengthen it, I do on a daily basis. Makes a world of difference for how I experience the world, you know, everything in it.
And it changes the world, too.
Yes, it does. Yes, and that's, and I love that we have, you know, we're on 10 acres here, and we've done so much. We got a 40 by 70 foot garden area and a 12 by 20 foot hoop house. We got a large chicken coop with 17 chickens, and
nice.
We just added the bees, and we're going to keep moving in the direction of, you know, self-sustaining, because I think that's really important, and plus the food is so much more vital and healthy. And what I've noticed is about the property just keeps, and the earth just keeps giving. You know, we appreciate it. We nurture it with manure and different types of things, and it just keeps producing more. So it's pretty exciting, and I think that's kind of how it's designed to do it, and rather than just taking and not giving anything back, there's a mutual exchange of energy, and I think it really appreciates us being here, and we appreciate everything that this plot of land is offering us on a regular basis.
Cool. One of the things being in the city here that I do when our gardens are going is usually on Mondays, I take a little drive around the neighborhood. I've got a rack on the back of my van, and I collect grass clippings and put them in the soil or in to build soil. We're actually the property we're on when we first came here 5 years ago, if you dug an inch beneath the lawn, all you had was red and gray clay. That was it. I mean, this whole hill's just solid clay and rock. And so we've been soil building forever. And to me, it's just so magical that, you know, you put a little hole in the soil that you've taken care of, and you drop this little thing in it, and wealth comes out of the ground. That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
And it's a wealth that's available to everybody, and so many people don't even bother, don't realize, I don't think, that that's a real possibility. And it's pretty amazing gift.
Yeah, generations of people who actually think that the grocery store must grow it when they're real young, you know.
Yeah.
That's where we get all our food, isn't it? You know, so that's important. I know you're talking about organic matter. It's vital for the health of the soil and the health of the earth. And when I had my garden back in Lansing in our previous home, literally 40 years, we put in, I averaged in the first 30 years, and we started out like you were describing, it took the guy 4 hours to do a 12 by 12 square, and all he could do is get down 2.5 to 3 inches, you know, to plow it up. I started putting in and doing, you know, organic gardening in that area, in that plot of property where we had our garden.
Right.
I put 75 bags of leaves every season at the end of the year in that garden. And it just sucked it up. By the time winter was over, it was all gone. You know, the ground just, it was almost as if all the creatures, well, not almost as if, they just consumed it. And it just turns into soil. And it's, and you know, the more of us that do something that's nurturing, I mean, Native Americans were so wise. They, if they took a plant or took something from, you know, the ground, they would always honor the earth by giving something back. In that case, a lot of times it was tobacco or something that was of a vital nature to them. And they never ran out of food. You know, they had all the food they needed. It was always there.
Definitely. One of the insights for me that came as we started working with the soil here is that you can't grow food on dirt. You've got to have soil. And most commercial so-called food that you get in the grocery store, the first thing they do is pour 10 gallons per acre of glyphosate onto the soil to make sure everything in the soil is dead, and now soil becomes dirt. And then take something that's totally dead and try to get something alive out of it. I think that's one of the reasons why this generation of young people, at least at this stage so far, is going to be the first generation in the history of America that the children are not going to live as long as the parents did. Their life expectancy is being reduced. And I think that's one of the reasons, because people are, you know, for the matter of profit, this whole game has been done. Well, we kill everything on the land, so now we have dirt. And, of course, you can't really uptake nutrients from dirt, so we'll get to sell you some chemical fertilizers, so there'll be nutrients that'll get into the food. Of course, it's not going to be the 380 nutrients that are designed. It'll just be NPK. There'll be three, but it makes things look like food. And of course, there's little to no nutrition. There's been a lot of research done on that. And there's no life in it. You can't get life from death. And you go to the grocery store and you buy that, and people wonder why, you know, our health statistics are becoming so tragic in this country. That's, I think, a big factor. And to me, the fact that I get to go out and work in the soil rather than paying to go to a gym is a whole lot more sane than going to the gym and the grocery store. it's definitely, for me, opened up a whole different world. And I can remember when I used to go visit you there and watch you work in that garden. And, of course, we had gardens at Heartland, but I never really got my hands in them. And so being here the last 5 years, it's been really pretty wonderful, pretty awesome for me. It's not something I ever really even considered that I would enjoy, but I'm loving it and having a blast. And as I say this morning, when I'm, definitely. Well, just the energetic patterns, the blessed gases that come off of those organisms, just breathing them directly, let alone taking them in through food, is a gift.
You started to say this morning?
Oh, just that was my project this morning, was out collecting, you know, amendments for the for a new, we're opening another area for our native species garden. And so went out and got a couple of hundred pounds of people's grass clippings and some twigs and such, and put it on a new area. We've just gotten that ready. I finished that off this morning with about six bags of grass clippings to create amendments and build soil. So,
well, you know,
delighted
you're
there doing the same.
Exactly. That addresses the question I had for you, because I know what I would do is I would also grab clippings, but I had made sure that they didn't use any of the glyphosate and the chemicals,
yes,
and the pesticides and so forth. But if you're putting it on the flower garden, that's still not optimal, but it's still going to feed it, and you're not eating it. So that's
right.
Why I asked if you pay attention to that as well. As long as you're not
before
putting it on the food garden.
Yeah, there are certain neighbors, you know, within about a mile and a half radius that I've come to know, and before I've taken, you know, they put their grass clippings out on the side of the road, the city comes along and takes them and actually composts them. But before I take a load, I'll knock on that person's door and say, mind if I take these clippings? And I've never had anybody say no. And then I ask, do you use any chemicals on it, any kind of pesticides or anything? And if they do, I don't touch it. But otherwise, so I've kind of come to know who people are and what they do. And so that's what I collect up. I've got kind of a route that I do. And, you know, people, I don't think people realize that, you know, for that blade of grass to grow, that takes a lot of vitality, a lot of nutrition. It takes a lot out of the soil, and people cut that stuff and just throw it away, or leaves. I mean, how deep, you know, our mix of leaves and such, how deep are those roots in that tree, and what are they bringing up from deep in the earth and putting it into the leaves, and then the leaves fall and people throw them away, or in some cases pay to get them taken away. It's like, that's nutrition. That's what are you doing with that? Most people don't have a clue and don't care.
Yeah, I like to call it green gold.
That's what
it's amazing.
It is.
Amazing. It breaks down so fast. Awesome.
Pretty cool. All right, my friend. Well, you have a blessed one.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye. Well, Miss Jeannie, what's on your mind today?
Well, what I was thinking of when you're talking about the Native Americans and blessing, you know, the being thankful and honoring the earth for giving back. And I thought of our apple tree out front. I mean, it used to produce little hard apples that you couldn't peel or cook or cut or anything. And a couple years ago, we started collecting them. And last year, the apples were so much better. I mean, they were just really nice apples. And then this year it's full of blossoms, and our peach tree is full of little tiny peach buds. And I think it's the same. You know, we've been giving and caring and loving, and you know, there's been no pesticides or poisons or anything put on the yards, and it's giving back in full abundance.
That's a great point. And actually, I don't think we even that particular tree that you're talking about, which the last 2 years has just given us some awesome tasting apples. I don't think the first couple of years we were here that there were any apples on that tree. And as we started to pay attention to that hill and started to plant native species flowers and such, and harvested it, and every time we would harvest the first year there were apples, anytime we would harvest them, we would thank the tree. And it does definitely seem to be responding. I mean, this year it's just, wow, just really out there. So
yeah.
Kind of like life. Appreciate it, and it happens.
And Terry had his hand up, but then he took it down. I don't know if he's at a place where he can still talk. I'm going to turn on his microphone. 336, you're on the air.
Hey, guys.
Hey there, Brother Terry. How are you, young man?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Beautiful, beautiful day, and enjoying the show. And I had hit the queue and then took it off because I stopped for a minute. But, yeah, I'm back. And was going to respond to the young lady's comment on the oxygen deal. So, and what I was going to add was my experience in doing the numerous breath sessions. And then the last few have been have had a characteristic that the previous ones didn't happen. And a lot of it is due to the change in my physiology because of the accident, okay? And the accident created a constriction and restriction, you know, especially this last session where you were encouraging me to open, expand, and get the full breaths in. And afterwards, I mean, it's the next day afterwards I'm talking, I had opened and expanded so much, I was sore physically. You know, I could feel where the bones had stretched, the muscles, and had opened that space up. And so naturally, I would think that that was allowing for the influx of loss of life-supporting oxygen, you know, and opening that up, stretching that structure out. But I was really amazed at how much it stretched me and how much it opened me up, that one session.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And for those who are listening, that's good input. And for those who are listening that don't know Terry, what's that, 4 years ago now, Terry, you had that fall?
Yes, it was 4 years ago, November. Mm-hmm.
So Terry's a contractor, and he was on the second story of a building on a walkway, and a railing had been taken off, and he didn't realize it. And well, you were carrying something, walking backward, and literally dropped 14 feet to flatten your back on a concrete floor. And pretty intense time.
Yeah, it was a horrible impact, and it just exploded my upper body, and it ended with a trip on a helicopter, a life flight to the bigger hospital. And the first comment the doctor made was, "Mr. Bowling, I don't know why you're alive," you know. And it was that intense. And it's been a journey. But that was one of the more beautiful pieces, was that last breath session and feeling that return and the opening. Because 8 of my ribs were broken loose front and back. So they were just hanging by the muscle tissue in there. So the body had tensed up in an effort to hold all that in place, keep it from moving to minimize the pain.
Right.
So a lot of restriction went on there, a lot of restriction. Mm-hmm.
Well, I congratulate you. I acknowledge you for the courage you had to face life and keep moving. After that fall, I mean, that was just monumental. And I know the first time I saw you after that happened, it was like, I had to breathe. And so delighted that that opening happened. And, you know, this Saturday and Sunday happen to be Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing weekend. So I'll hold the space that you get even the next level of opening this weekend.
All right.
Cool. All right, Terry, we appreciate you. Cherish you.
Same here.
All right, take care. I'm glad you appreciate you and cherish you. That's great.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right, sir. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Blessings.
All right. So awesome to extend life. So, Ms. Jeannie, it looks like we're down to about 3 minutes or so. Do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room or any other questions to answer?
No, it's all quiet. There is a comment from Podbean says, on a side note, I love Terry's voice. What a journey, a loved sibling.
Nice.
There is a hand just went up, and we are down to 4 minutes, but let's see what we can do quickly. It's Celinda, 541. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael and Jeannie. This, you just said, Celinda.
welcome.
I wanted to call. Yes.
Just welcoming you. How you be, young lady?
I'd be fine. We're both waiting for the other to take a breath and speak. I'm fine, thank you. I have a real quickie for you. In reference to the asparagus, is asparagus good for cancer? A treatment, you know, as an alternative treatment to cancer. And when my grandmother had breast cancer in, I think it was the early 70s, and I had found a whole bunch of old prevention magazines on the free shelf at the library, and I brought them home. I went through them, and there was an article in there in prevention about cancer research and cancer asparagus being a vegetable that seemed to really help cancer patients into remission and or improvement. The only admonition it had was it didn't work if you already had chemotherapy. And you could eat it, it said, you could eat canned asparagus, you could eat fresh asparagus, you know, it didn't matter. But
right.
Once the person had gone through chemo, they didn't find it worked anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, uplifting. And as I say, you know, it's obvious there's some kind of a detox going on. If you eat asparagus, an hour later you pee. It's very clear that something's being moved out of the system.
That's really interesting, too, because I remember seeing an old Seventh-day Adventist video, and they said, oh, don't eat asparagus, it's toxic. So it goes to show you how knowledge is built upon knowledge and how we do stand on the shoulders of the past as we move forward in our revelations.
Yes.
And our research. Yeah. And that's all I had.
Yeah.
To share. Unfortunately,
all right,
my grandmama had chemo already, so that didn't work for her. Well, love and blessings.
Okay. We'll see you out enjoying the garden.
Yeah, I'm going this afternoon.
All right. Have a blessed one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.